Did you think I've forgotten about the Mad Monk Squad of DARPA, who received this original crazy proposal? Reasons for rejection. The Biological Technologies Office of DARPA reviewed the EcoHealth Alliance Diffuse proposal and the evaluation reports and decided it was selectable. In doing so, 2 out of 3 reviewers considered the aim of preempting zoonotic spillover through reduction of viral shedding in the bat caves as of interest to DARPA. These reviewers assessed the EHA and collaborators team and concluded that they have plenty of prior experience. They have access to Yunnan caves where bats are infected with SARS-R viruses. They have carried out past surveillance work. They have developed geo-based risk maps of zoonotic hotspots. Their proposed experimental work is logical and can validate molecular and evolutionary models. Their proposed preemption approaches can rapidly be validated using bat and batonized mouse models. However, the Biological Technologies Office did not recommend it be funded at that time because significant weaknesses were identified. 1. The proposal is considered to potentially involve GOF-DURC research because they propose to synthesize spike glycoproteins which bind to human cell receptors and insert them into SARS-CoV backbones to assess whether they can cause SARS-like disease. 2. However, the proposal does not mention or assess potential risks of gain-of-function GOF research. 3. Nor does the proposal mention or assess dual-use research of concern, DURC issues, and this fails to present a DURC risk mitigation plan. 4. The proposal hardly addresses or discusses ethical, legal, and social issues, ELSI. 5. The proposal fails to discuss problems with the proposed vaccine delivery systems caused by the known issues of variability in vaccine dosage. 6. The proposal did not provide sufficient information about how EHA would use any data obtained and how they would model development or perform any necessary statistical analysis. 7. The proposal did not explain clearly how EHA will take advantage of their previous work, nor how that previous work could be extended. 8. The proposal failed to clearly assess how it would deploy and validate the TA2 preemption methods in the wild. This refers to carrying out experiments with effective immune-boosting molecules and delivery techniques via FEA aerosolization mechanism at 1 test and 2 control bat cave sites in Yunnan, China, PARC, EHA-WIV. 9. The proposal does not address concerns about these vaccines not being able to protect against the wide variety of coronaviruses in bat caves, which are constantly evolving due to insufficient epitope coverage. Drastic independently assesses that the tone of the proposal, see for instance the Our Cave Complex, and the deep suggested involvement of some of the WIV parties, Xi Zhengli, employed half-time for 3 years, paid via the grant, and invited to DARPA headquarters at Arlington, may not have helped either, especially in the absence of any DURC risk mitigation program. It is clear that the proposed Diffuse project, led by Peter Daszak, could have put local communities at risk by failing to consider the following issues: gain of function, dual use research of concern, vaccine epitope coverage, regulatory requirements, ELSI, ethical, legal, and social issues, data usage. End. It's difficult to imagine a more devastating rejection letter from a military intelligence research agency known for taking risks. But that is exactly what was given by DARPA to Peter Daszak's proposal from EcoHealth Alliance. Let's see if we can put all of this into perspective. We know from Dr. Andrew Huff, the former vice president and senior scientist at EcoHealth Alliance, that one of the alliances they likely had was with the CIA. We see from the DARPA rejection that they were terrified by the proposal to synthesize spike glycoproteins, which bind to human cell receptors and insert them into SARS-CoV backbones to assess whether they can cause SARS-like disease, and did not think Daszak had properly considered the risk of gain of function, the possible deadly results from these experiments, or dual use risk of concern. He also had not provided any risk mitigation plan. DARPA did not believe problems with the vaccine delivery system had been addressed. DARPA could not understand how the data would be used. DARPA was skeptical that the proposed mitigation programs at the caves would work. Perhaps the most serious of the criticisms leveled by DARPA relates to the potentially compromised loyalty and judgment of Peter Daszak. They were troubled by the fact that he referred to the Yunnan caves in China as our cave complex, as well as the fact that DARPA was being asked to pay half the salary of a Chinese virologist, Xi Zhengli, and that she had been invited to DARPA headquarters in Arlington, Virginia. It is likely that DARPA leadership was unaware that EcoHealth Alliance may have had an alliance with the CIA, and that Daszak probably believed this gave him carte blanche to show this Chinese researcher all around the DARPA facilities. It can be difficult to understand Daszak's game plan, whether it was executed with a full understanding of our intelligence agencies, or whether this was something he cooked up on his own and got people to agree to without a full understanding of the dangers of his scheme. But in any event, Peter Daszak, more than any person on the planet, likely bears the greatest responsibility for the more than 6 million people who lost their lives in the COVID-19 pandemic. We need to spend some time with Chinese scientist Xi Zhengli, often referred to as Bat Woman, for her work with bat coronaviruses. This is how the New York Times described the increasingly embattled position in which she found herself in June 2021. As questions continue to be raised about whether SARS-CoV-2 escaped from the Wuhan Institute of Virology. To a growing chorus of American politicians and scientists, she is the key to whether the world will ever learn if the virus behind the devastating COVID-19 pandemic escaped from a Chinese lab. To the Chinese government and public, she is a hero of the country's success in curbing the epidemic and a victim of malicious conspiracy theories. Xi Zhengli, a top Chinese virologist, is once again at the center of clashing narratives about her research on coronaviruses at a state lab in Wuhan, the city where the pandemic first emerged. The idea that the virus may have escaped from a lab has been widely dismissed by scientists as implausible and shunned by others for its connection with former President Donald J. Trump. But fresh scrutiny from the Biden administration and calls for greater candor from prominent scientists have brought the theory back to the fore. Remember when I said that it's fine to read mainstream news media, like the New York Times or the Washington Post, if you understand that while they may not tell the truth initially, if you read and pay attention long enough, they might eventually tell the truth? This article is a prime example of that view. If you read it with a critical eye, it contains many startling admissions. In other words, if Dr. Xi Zhengli gave these same answers in a court of law, she'd likely be found guilty by a jury in a few hours and be sent to jail for a long time. But first, the New York Times had to give the defense to Dr. Xi, courtesy of Dr. Robert Gallo, who was famously forced to leave government service for trying to steal credit for the discovery of the HIV virus from French researcher Dr. Luc Montagnier, who was eventually awarded the Nobel Prize for this research in 2008. In less polarized times, Dr. Xi was a symbol of China's scientific progress at the forefront of research into emerging viruses. She led expeditions into caves to collect samples from bats and guano to learn how viruses jump from animals to humans. In 2019, she was among 109 scientists elected to the American Academy of Microbiology for her contributions to the field. She's a stellar scientist, extremely careful, with a rigorous work ethic, said Dr. Robert C. Gallo, director of the Institute of Human Virology at the University of Maryland School of Medicine. The New York Times reporters covering this story gave us the positive information about Dr. Xi, but then, like good attorneys, they listened and provided their readers with the answers from Dr. Xi that showed that the claims leveled against her were likely to be true. But some of her most notable findings have since drawn the greatest scrutiny. In recent years, Dr. Xi began experimenting on bat coronaviruses by genetically modifying them to see how they behave. In 2017, she and her colleagues at the Wuhan lab published a paper about an experiment in which they created new hybrid bat coronaviruses by mixing and matching parts of several existing ones, including at least one that was nearly transmissible to humans, in order to study their ability to infect and replicate in human cells. Proponents of this type of research say it helps society prepare for future outbreaks. Critics say the risks of creating dangerous new pathogens may outweigh potential benefits. How crazy does all this sound? They are admitting out in the open that they're creating potentially dangerous new pathogens and that these pathogens may devastate human society. But it's all presented in a relatively bloodless, well, on one hand, and yet on the other, type of justification. But the price of getting it wrong is unleashing a deadly global pathogen. Now, here's where the article gets really nuts. And I wonder how much of a fight went on between the reporters, who generally seemed interested in getting to the bottom of this very important question, and the editors of the New York Times. The picture has been complicated by new questions about whether American government funding that went to Dr. Xi's work supported controversial gain-of-function research. The Wuhan Institute received around $600,000 in grant money from the United States government through an American nonprofit called EcoHealth Alliance. The National Institutes of Health said it had not approved funding for the nonprofit to conduct gain-of-function research on coronaviruses that would have made them more infectious or lethal. Dr. Xi, in an emailed response to questions, argued that her experiments differed from gain-of-function work because she did not set out to make a virus more dangerous, but to understand how it might jump between species. My lab has never conducted or cooperated in conducting GOF experiments that enhance the virulence of viruses, she said. In any other situation, this would have been an acknowledgement that, hell yeah, we were doing gain-of-function research. How else is one supposed to interpret the claim that her experiments differed from gain-of-function work because she did not set out to make a virus more dangerous, but to understand how it might jump between species? It sounds to me that she was performing whatever procedures necessary to make the virus transmissible to humans, but she was doing this to see how it could happen, not to make the virus more deadly. What is left unsaid, though, is that she might very well have made the virus more deadly, even though that wasn't her intention. Kind of like your teenagers choosing to throw a football around inside the house, and then when they break a lamp or window, they escape punishment by saying, "I didn't mean to do that." Sometimes the very act of performing a dangerous act is enough to place blame when an accident happens. On the question of how much money the United States government and Anthony Fauci's National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases paid to the Wuhan Institute of Virology, I present this article from Newsweek from April 2020. But just last year, the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases, the organization led by Dr. Fauci, funded scientists at the Wuhan Institute of Virology and other institutions for work on gain-of-function research on bat coronaviruses. In 2019, with the backing of NIAID, the National Institutes of Health committed $3.7 million over 6 years for research that included some gain-of-function work. The program followed another $3.7 million five-year project for collecting and studying bat coronaviruses, which ended in 2019, bringing the total to $7.4 million. This is the kind of information that should be at the front of every article about coronavirus deaths around the world. All it would need to be is a single paragraph, maybe like the community notes that Elon Musk now has on X, Twitter. It would read something like, "Although not proven, any person who is not an idiot suspects that the bat coronavirus research approved by Anthony Fauci's National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases and Gain-of-Function Research, performed at the Wuhan Institute of Virology in China, are responsible for the global outbreak." The Newsweek article was exceptionally clear in describing this research. The NIH research consisted of two parts. The first part began in 2014. And involved surveillance of bat coronaviruses, and had a budget of $3.7 million. The program, funded Shi Zheng Li, a virologist at the Wuhan lab, and other researchers to investigate and catalog bat coronaviruses in the wild. This part of the project was completed in 2019. A second phase of the project, beginning that year, included additional surveillance work, but also gain-of-function research, for the purpose of understanding how bat coronaviruses could mutate to attack humans. The project was run by EcoHealth Alliance, a nonprofit research group, under the direction of President Peter Daszak, an expert on disease ecology. NIH canceled the project just this past Friday, April 24th, Politico reported. Daszak did not immediately respond to Newsweek requests for comment. The project proposal states, "We will use S protein data sequence, infectious clone technology, in vitro and in vivo infection experiments, and analysis of receptor binding to test the hypothesis that percent divergence thresholds in S protein sequences predict spillover potential." The article went on to note that spillover potential refers to the ability of a virus to jump from animals to humans, and that SARS-CoV-2 was adept at binding to the ACE2 receptor in human lungs and other organs. Does this begin to give a flavor of the relationship between the Wuhan Institute of Virology and the U.S. health establishment with Anthony Fauci's National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases right in the middle of it? Think of somebody you've worked with for 6 years. Chances are it's a pretty close relationship, especially if you had to go to the other side of the world to make it work. Maybe it's understandable why Fauci didn't want the country asking too many questions about his long-term relationship with the Chinese scientists, even if they may have also been keeping secrets from him. How did President Trump handle the COVID-19 pandemic? Really bad. His instincts were good, but he didn't follow them. In the end, he listened to the deep state establishment. People like Fauci, Alex Azar, head of Health and Human Services, and Scott Gottlieb, head of the Food and Drug Administration, both former lobbyists for Big Pharma. Early in the crisis, Trump was skeptical of the information he was receiving from the COVID-19 task force, which was why, in April 2020, a call was placed to Dr. Paul Alexander, who at the time was advising the World Health Organization and the Pan American Health Organization as an evidence synthesizer for the COVID pandemic, as well as working for the Infectious Diseases Society of America. As Paul recalls in his book, Presidential Takedown, how Anthony Fauci, the CDC, NIH, and the WHO conspired to overthrow President Trump, co-authored with my co-author on this book, Kent Heckenlively. After saying hello to the caller, my wife was quiet for a few minutes. I wondered if it was some solicitor with a really good pitch, because she usually hangs up rather quickly with one of those calls, but she didn't. Instead, in a rather quiet voice, she said, "Paul, it's someone saying they are talking from or on behalf of the White House and U.S. government, and they want to talk to you." I took the phone from her and said, "This is Dr. Paul Alexander," not quite believing her. The person speaking on behalf of the White House, sounding credible enough, identified himself and the nature of his call, and then said, "We know of some things you've said publicly, and read some of the recent papers you published on different issues, and that's gotten the attention of persons in the Oval Office. They wanted to know if you'd be interested in joining the administration and having a seat at the table." "Are you guys joking?" I asked, still not believing this was real. The man on the other end of the line replied, "Well, no. We want to know if you want to have a seat at the table. We've done our study of you, and we realized you could be an asset to the administration. You are somebody who can be trusted, and we like your technical competence, and we want you to join us." I think it's important for the reader to understand what I say next, because it best explains my frame of mind as I began my work. "Are you saying the task force can't be trusted?" I asked. I tend to be very blunt and brutally honest, especially in these types of situations. There was a pause on the other end of the line. "The president wants to expand the table with people he trusts and who are optimally competent." "So he doesn't trust them?" I asked, pressing the question again. "I wouldn't put it that way," he replied. "He doesn't feel he's being fully, properly, and optimally served by the present members of the task force. We want other people in those meetings, giving their insight. If we're all in agreement, we're good. If not, well, we have to figure out the next steps. Will you join us?" This passage fills me with many mixed emotions. On the one hand, it highlights the things I loved about Trump, like his willingness to have different thinkers in the room, sometimes a veritable rogues gallery of outcasts, the same kind of patriots who made this country, and on the other, this is the man who agreed to 15 days to slow the spread, which turned into years of lockdowns, harming children and devastating small businesses, as well as sanctioning an insane warp-speed COVID vaccine development, and doing nothing when his public health establishment went after therapeutics, killing hundreds of thousands of Americans and millions around the world. He had the pirates and the renegades at the table, and he sided with the establishment. That's the way I see it. Is it an excuse to say he's simply one of those people of a certain age who thinks of vaccines as some kind of a miracle moonshot? And as much as he's listened to stories of vaccine damage, he couldn't quite pull the trigger and investigate what they're doing to people? I know people who are supporting Trump despite this glaring flaw, and those who say his failure during COVID-19 means they could never support him again. I understand both positions, and I don't judge. I am genuinely uncertain how I will vote in 2024. What I am certain of is that I will keep telling you the truth as I see it. This is what Dr. Alexander wrote about the viper's nest Trump found himself in. They, Dr. Fauci, Dr. Birx, and the deep state technocrats at CDC, NIH, FDA, etc., lied to him about the lockdowns. They lied to him about therapeutics, and they lied to him about the vaccines. They collectively lied to him daily and conspired to make the United States ungovernable, unmanageable, chaotic, distraught, and a disaster. This was told to me bluntly by officials in government who I would say are part of the deep state bureaucracy. They, Dr. Fauci and Dr. Birx and others, ensured the lockdowns were long, hardened, painful, and destructive, so that President Trump would be blamed. The accrued harms and death from the lockdown policies rests at their feet. I tried to tell the task force about the poor safety testing of the vaccines so that there would be a permanent record of what had been done. Nobody listened. Everything about that passage makes sense and rings true to me. Trump was in a tough position, perhaps the toughest position any president ever found himself in. And as for those who still defend Trump as acting as best as he could during the crisis, let me provide this piece of information about the near-absolute control people like Anthony Fauci and Francis Collins had over the scientific establishment. NIH received $41.6 billion in FY, fiscal year 2020. Of this amount, $30.8 billion was awarded to 56 and 169 new and renewed meritorious extramural grants, excludes research and development contracts. This investment was up $1.3 billion from fiscal year 2019, 4.4% increase, with 1,157 more grants funded, 2.1% increase. These awards were made to 2,650 academic universities, hospitals, and other organizations throughout the U.S. and internationally. Dr. Francis Collins, head of NIH, and Dr. Anthony Fauci, head of the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases, and the highest paid individual in the U.S. government, had more than $30 billion a year to hand out to their friends in science. That buys a lot of influence in science. By comparison, in the 2020 election, both political parties spent only a combined $5.7 billion to elect a U.S. president. Collins and Fauci had an essential slush fund to buy influence in science that, on a yearly basis, was more than five times greater than the amount we spend to elect a president of the United States every 4 years. And can we say that Dr. Francis Collins and Dr. Anthony Fauci acted honorably during the COVID-19 crisis, promoting reasonable scientific debate, especially when it came to dissenting voices? We cannot. Probably the most vivid example of their iron-fisted control over science was the attack Collins and Fauci launched on three researchers: Martin Kulldorff from Harvard University, Sunetra Gupta from Oxford University, and Jay Bachara from Stanford University. These three had created something called the Great Barrington Declaration, which argued that the evidence favored focused protection of high-risk populations, such as the elderly, those with chronic health conditions, and the obese, but that the rest of the population, the healthy working class and professionals, as well as children, should continue with their regular lives. This is what the editors of the Wall Street Journal wrote in a December 2021 opinion piece when it was revealed that Collins and Fauci had colluded in a scheme to sideline these experts. In public, Anthony Fauci and Francis Collins urged Americans to follow the science. In private, the two sainted public health officials schemed to quash dissenting views from top scientists. That's the troubling but fair conclusion from emails obtained recently via the Freedom of Information Act by the American Institute for Economic Research. The tale unfolded in October 2020, after the launch of the Great Barrington Declaration, a statement by Harvard's Martin Kulldorff, Oxford's Sunetra Gupta, and Stanford's Jay Bachara against blanket pandemic lockdowns. They favored a policy of what they called focused protection of high-risk populations, such as the elderly or those with medical conditions. Thousands of scientists signed the declaration, if they were able to learn about it. We tried to give it some election in these pages. In any other instance, this attack on fellow scientists would have resulted in Fauci and Collins being driven from science and having their names forever listed among the greatest traitors to our nation, like Revolutionary War turncoat Benedict Arnold. But $30 billion a year buys one a lot of friends in science. The editorial board of the Wall Street Journal continued its condemnation of Fauci and Collins. Focused protection of nursing homes and other high-risk populations remains the policy road not taken during the pandemic. Perhaps this strategy wouldn't have prevailed if a debate had been allowed, but it isn't enough to repeat, as Dr. Collins did on Fox News Sunday, that advocates are fringe epidemiologists who really did not have the credentials, and that hundreds of thousands would have died if we followed that strategy. More than 800,000 Americans have died, as much of the country followed the strategy of Drs. Collins and Fauci, and that's not counting the cost in lost livelihoods, shuttered businesses, untreated illnesses, mental illness from isolation, and the incalculable anguish of seeing loved ones die alone, without the chance for a family to say goodbye. Rather than try to manipulate public opinion, the job of health officials is to offer their best scientific advice. They shouldn't act like politicians or censors, and when they do, they squander the public's trust. I believe all of this is true. Trump was like a lion surrounded by a pack of wolves. And yet, he sold himself to us as the meanest SOB on the block, able to see through the lies and do the right thing. COVID-19 was the hill a worthy president should have fought and died upon. What was the result of our lockdown policy? It hurt our children. This is from a September 2022 article by the New York Times on the effect of the lockdown on American students. This year, For the first time since the National Assessment of Educational Progress tests began tracking student achievement in the 1970s, 9-year-olds lost ground in math, and scores in reading fell by the largest margin in more than 30 years. The declines spanned almost all races and income levels, and were markedly worse for the lowest performing students. While top performers in the 90th percentile showed a modest drop, 3 points in math, students in the bottom 10th percentile dropped by 12 points in math, 4 times the impact. "I was taken aback by the scope and magnitude of the decline," said Peggy G. Carr, commissioner of the National Center for Education Statistics, the federal agency that administered the exam earlier this year. The tests were given to a national sample of 14,800 9-year-olds and were compared with the results of tests taken by the same age group in early 2020, just before the pandemic took hold in the United States. "All of this was unnecessary," a paper in the Journal of the American Medical Association from June 2020 detailed not only the relatively few children who had come down with the virus, but also a possible explanation as to why this was true. "Children account for less than 2% of identified cases of coronavirus disease, 2019, COVID-19. It is hypothesized that the lower risk among children is due to differential expression of angiotensin-converting enzyme, ACE2, the receptor that severe acute respiratory syndrome coronavirus 2, SARS-CoV-2, uses for host entry. We investigated ACE2 gene expression in nasal epithelium of children and adults." It's probably best to imagine the ACE2 receptor on a cell as a flower that needs to be open so a bee can land on it to collect nectar. If the flower hasn't bloomed, then it doesn't make any sense for the bee to land on it since it can't collect any nectar. Imagine the SARS-CoV-2 virus as a bee buzzing around your body. But instead of looking for a flower, it's looking for a cell with an ACE2 receptor active and open, so it can gain access to the cell. In children, for the most part, the ACE2 receptor is not open. It's why children, by and large, avoided the infection. And when they did become sick, their symptoms were generally mild. The results from this study show age-dependent expression of ACE2 in nasal epithelium, the first point of contact for SARS-CoV-2 and the human body. Corviat-adjusted models show that the positive association between ACE2 gene expression was independent of sex and asthma. Lower ACE2 expression in children relative to adults may help explain why COVID-19 is less prevalent in children. The simplest way to understand this research is to realize that children, by and large, cannot get severely sick with COVID-19 because the virus cannot get into significant numbers of the cells and replicate. Low viral numbers in the body mean that the innate immune system will deal with the virus fairly quickly, usually in a few days. How much did the failure to implement early treatment affect the hospitalization and death rate from COVID-19? This is an article from the Brownstone Institute written by Dr. Paul Alexander, Trump's former senior pandemic advisor, which sought to answer that question. The evidence accumulated very early on in the pandemic that the use of sequenced multi-drug therapeutics, SDMT, under physician guidance was beneficial, and that some medications were safe and effective. We refer to repurposed therapeutics that have been regulatory approved and have been used in some instances for decades for other illnesses. We have extensively written and published treatment algorithms and protocols, as well as evidence of the benefit of early outpatient ambulatory treatment, of SARS, CoV-2 virus, and the consequent disease COVID-19. With highly targeted and SMDT regimens that include early application of antiviral drugs combined with corticosteroids and antiplatelet, antithrombotic, anti-clotting therapeutics, the risk of hospitalization is significantly reduced by as much as 85 to 95%, and the risk of death is eliminated for high-risk patients and younger individuals presenting with severe symptoms. COVID-19 presents as either a mild flu-like condition, asymptomatic or mild symptoms, or more serious illness in those at high risk. A small fraction of persons infected with COVID virus progress to more serious illness, typically elderly with underlying medical conditions, obese, or younger with underlying medical conditions or risk factors. The complex and multidimensional pathophysiology of life-threatening COVID-19 illness, including viral-mediated organ damage, cytokine storm, and thrombosis, warrants early interventions to address all components of the illness. According to the World Health Organization, as of June 7, 2023, there have been 6,941,095 deaths from COVID-19, with the worldwide case total being 767,750,853. While Dr. Alexander claims that early intervention would have essentially eliminated deaths, let's take the most conservative number he gave for the benefits of early intervention, which was an 85% reduction in hospitalizations, and use that as a proxy for reductions in death. That means early intervention would likely have saved at least 5,899,930 lives, with a reduced global death toll of 1,041,164 deaths. What has been the result of the COVID-19 vaccines? Many have raised the question of whether these vaccines are causing an increase in excess deaths, as suggested by this January 10, 2023 article from the BBC, with the title, Excess Deaths in 2022 Among Worst in 50 Years. More than 650,000 deaths were registered in the UK in 2022, 9% more than in 2019. This represents one of the largest excess death levels outside the pandemic in 50 years. Though far below peak pandemic levels, it has prompted questions about why more people are dying than normal. COVID is still killing people, but is involved in fewer deaths now than at the start of the pandemic. Roughly 38,000 deaths involved COVID in 2022, compared with more than 95,000 in 2020. We are still seeing more deaths overall than would be expected based on recent history. Of course, the BBC article went on to speculate that the excess deaths were due to people missing medical appointments, and there may be some contribution from that. But as for me, I suspect the vaccine is harming a large number of people we are not currently counting. I am particularly intrigued by the investigation of the Pfizer documents currently being spearheaded by Dr. Naomi Wolf. Dr. Wolf is the author of 7 national bestsellers, has associated with the third wave of the feminist movement, and advised President Bill Clinton in 1996, as well as Vice President Al Gore during the 2000 election. In the years since 2000, she has made an interesting political evolution, coming to side with conservatives on many issues, while still retaining her strong feminist beliefs. You can find her excellent writing on Substack, Outspoken with Dr. Naomi Wolf. This is what she said at a recent event, as reported by the Daily Clout. One thing people have been able to do for thousands of years is to have sex and have babies without any intervention or help from anyone else. It's a tremendous way that the human race is self-reliant, that it can survive catastrophe. Well, the tech brothers, and probably China, want to take that away from us. This is clear in the Pfizer documents. There's a section of the Pfizer documents in which Pfizer breaks down the adverse events and concludes that women sustained 72% of them, she continued. And of those, and these are Pfizer's words, 16% are, quote-unquote, reproductive disorders, compared to 0.49% for men. So they're very focused on reproduction, female reproduction. It's my belief that they were trying to disrupt especially female reproduction, Dr. Wolf determined. And the question is, how do I know that? And the answer is from the structure of what they looked at. Again, I'm a literary critic, but this is a mystery novel in which the question is, how do we stop women from having healthy babies? That's the story of the Pfizer documents. Dr. Wolf detailed super strange things with the Pfizer documents, such as 10-year-old girls menstruating on first being injected, and long postmenopausal women in their 80s and 90s bleeding again after being injected. While some may dispute her assertions that the pattern of what they looked at suggests what they wanted to do, I find myself in agreement with her that this seems to be part of a depopulation agenda. Further in the article, she says, "So now it's 2023, mourned Dr. Wolf, as those fertility problems have come to fruition. Igor Chudov compared databases in countries around the world. There are 1 million missing babies in Europe. They never got born. There are double the number of miscarriages and spontaneous abortions in Scotland, and a 13-20% drop in live births around the world. There are 2 or 3 times the number of spontaneous abortions and miscarriages in Tel Aviv as before, and so on around the world. And now we know why. Now we know the mechanism. It's not just an attack on us. It's not just a mass murder, which is the language that Ofcom objected to, but it's an existential attack. And think about it chronologically. I'm very worried that a source in Britain said they wanted to embargo this information for 20 years, because I'm like, what do they expect to have happened in 20 years? I think this is the tip of the iceberg, she continued. We've, Daily Clout, War Room volunteers, got a report on turbo cancers. We've got a report on strokes. We've got a report on liver damage, kidney damage. I don't want to depress you, but all around you are people who are suffering from illnesses, mourned Dr. Wolf. None of their doctors are telling them that these illnesses are in the Pfizer documents as side effects. And now we understand the mechanisms of them. Did I ever think I'd be on the same side about the global depopulation agenda as a former Clinton and Gore advisor? I did not, but I am happy to have Dr. Wolf in the fight. Am I going to be forced to say something nice about the alien robot boy, Mark Zuckerberg? I'd encourage you to be alert to any possible movement away from darkness among our enemies. So I guess I have to be consistent, right? On June 9th, 2023, in an interview on the Lex Fridman podcast, Mark Zuckerberg, CEO of Facebook, now Meta, lamented the censorship decisions he made during the COVID-19 lockdown. In some ways, it made me want to scream even louder. But maybe that's not the most positive reaction. I'll let you decide. The Facebook CEO said that the medical establishment often waffled on COVID claims and requested the removal of material that ended up being debatable or true. Just take some of the stuff around COVID earlier in the pandemic, where there were real health implications, but there hadn't been time to fully vet a bunch of the scientific assumptions, said Zuckerberg. Unfortunately, I think a lot of the kind of establishment on that kind of stuff waffled on a bunch of facts and asked for a bunch of things to be censored that, in retrospect, ended up being more debatable or true. That stuff is really tough, right? It really undermines trust. On the one hand, I guess I should be happy that Zuckerberg has come to the realization that the medical establishment lied to him or put forth dubious assertions, which only served to strengthen their financial interests. But the point I've made time and again in this book is that nobody should have the power to censor public debate. There has never been a time in human history when the censors have been the good guys. The challenge in any society is not how to restrain the people, but how to restrain the government or powerful interests. God made man in his own image, not corporations, governments, or activist groups. Nobody has been a more eloquent voice in this debate than Robert Kennedy Jr., as shown in the November 2021 speech he gave at the Ron Paul Institute and their conference on Pandemic and the Road to Totalitarianism. Kennedy described a recent simulation, Event 201, a pandemic tabletop exercise that simulated a global pandemic nearly identical to COVID. The event took place in October 2019 at the Johns Hopkins Center for Health Security. Dr. Tom Inglesby, director of the Center for Health Security, facilitated the simulation. Bill Gates of the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, global health officers, and people from social media groups, large pharmaceutical companies, and global corporations attended or sent representatives. Kennedy said, "What were they simulating?" They were simulating a pandemic, but they weren't simulating a medical response to that pandemic. They were simulating a militarized response. How do you use that pandemic to, particularly in that event 201, to impose censorship globally? And that's what they were modeling. Describing CIA operations and organized mind control programs at top universities, conducted on expendable subjects, such as the military and incarcerated, Kennedy said the same techniques are used in today's lockdowns. The most potent technique, incidentally, that they learned again and again and again, more potent than physical torture, was isolation. And they did this in sensory deprivation tanks, and also just locking people in solitary confinement. You can get people to do almost anything you want after a certain period of time. It will drive them mad, because we're social animals. We're social beings. And when you tear the social fabric, it makes people desperate, fearful, and obedient to do anything. We are meant to live in community with each other, sharing our thoughts and feelings. When tyrants seek to control society, they do it by separating people, sowing division amongst us, and hoping we will choose to self-isolate. But don't succumb to their drug of division. Every person should make a declaration that they will listen to different opinions with an open heart and mind, point out any errors of fact or interpretation they see, and be without fear in deciding whether a good argument has been made. The only remedy for speech with which you do not agree is to make a better argument. More than 3 years after COVID-19 caused the lockdown of our country, we started to get information we should have had in the first 3 days, such as the names of the first 3 people infected and what they shared, such as maybe a fondness for bat soup. That was not what they shared. It was, instead, a similar place of employment, the Wuhan Institute of Virology. From the New York Post on June 13, 2023. Scientists conducting research on novel coronaviruses at the Wuhan Institute of Virology were the first humans to contract COVID-19, according to a new report. Patients zero included Ben Hu, Ping Yu, and Yan Zhu, scientists researching SARS-like viruses at the institute, according to an investigation by journalists Michael Schellenberger and Matt Taibbi, published on the Substack newsletter Public. The three scientists were researching gain-of-function experiments with the virus, which increases the infectiousness and makes pathogens stronger in order to better understand their dangers. When they became sick in the fall of 2019, multiple U.S. government officials reportedly told the journalists. What would have been the effect of this information coming to light in March or April 2020? It would have rightly informed the world of the origin of the virus, shown a spotlight on dangerous scientific practices, and probably kept Trump in the White House. Everybody in America would have been calling it the China virus, because it would have been accurate. And do you know who would not have led the COVID response? Not Anthony Fauci, who approved this dangerous research. Anybody associated with Fauci would have had a bad smell, and we might have had an effective response to the virus, including the use of easily administered therapeutics like hydroxychloroquine and ivermectin, dramatically reducing the death rate. Was all of this a cover-your-ass move, or does it suggest something much more nefarious? Is there a I-was-just-trying-to-keep-some-things-secret defense to mass murder? I'll consult with my lawyers on that question, but I'll go out on a limb and say there isn't. The facts get even worse, as detailed in the article. In 2019, two of the allegedly infected scientists, Hu and Yu, co-authored a paper about the genetic lineage of SARS-related coronavirus in bats across China that they had studied. Hu studied under virologist Shi Zhengli, who is known as the Batwoman of China, for her research on SARS-like coronaviruses of bat origin. Zhengli has come under intense scrutiny since the outbreak of COVID-19 was traced back to Wuhan. Ben Hu is essentially the next Shi Zhengli. Alina Chen, a molecular biologist at the Broad Institute of MIT and Harvard, told Public. He was her star pupil. He had been making chimeric SARS-like viruses and testing these in humanized mice. If I had to guess who would be doing this risky virus research and most at risk of getting accidentally infected, it would be him. It's like the scene in the classic film Casablanca, where Rick says, "Of all the gin joints in all the world, and she had to walk into mine." Coincidence? Of all the people in the world to first come down with COVID-19, the first three were scientists at the Wuhan Institute of Virology, including the star pupil of the Batwoman of China. And what does she have to say of this amazing coincidence? Dr. Shi has repeatedly denied the allegations that her or her students' research caused the devastating pandemic due to a lab leak. She has called the allegations that multiple of her colleagues had gotten ill with similar symptoms to COVID-19 before the outbreak emerged baseless, and said that her lab did not hold any source of the strain that caused the pandemic in a June 2021 interview with the New York Times. I don't know how the world has come to this, constantly pouring filth on an innocent scientist, she said over text. Deflecting blame onto others may work in communist China, but in the more skeptical West, we have some additional questions. We don't believe her denials, just as we don't believe the denials of our own public health agencies about the origin of the virus, the lockdown and masking protocols, or the safety of the vaccines they have pushed as a result. Are we looking at powerful individuals who are evil or stupid, or possibly both? In an environment where so much is hidden from the view of the public, what are we to make of what is genuinely happening behind the scenes? Is this a depopulation agenda? I suggest that in the absence of evidence, one must assume the very worst about these powerful forces. However, at the very least, these scientists seem to resemble children playing with matches and gasoline on a global scale and hoping they don't burn down the planet. What does this all mean to us and our future? I believe we have been through nothing less than a great war, and although there have been high casualties, there have also been victories. I point to a Pew Research Center poll from 2022 as evidence for this position. Overall, 29% of U.S. adults say they have a great deal of confidence in medical scientists to act in the best interests of the public, down from 40% who said this in November 2020. Similarly, the share with a great deal of confidence in scientists to act in the public's best interests is down by 10 percentage points, from 39% to 29%, according to a new Pew Research Center survey. Scientists and medical scientists are not the only groups and institutions to see their confidence ratings decline in the last year. The share of Americans who say they have a great deal of confidence in the military to act in the public's best interests has fallen from 39% in November 2020 to 25% in the current survey. And the share of Americans with a great deal of confidence in K-12 public school principals and police officers have also decreased by 7 and 6 points, respectively. The public continues to express lower levels of confidence in journalists, business leaders, and elected officials, though even for these groups, public confidence is tilting more negative. 4 in 10 say they have a great deal or a fair amount of confidence in journalists and business leaders to act in the public's best interests. 6 in 10 now say they have not too much or no confidence at all in these groups. Ratings for elected officials are especially negative. 24% say they have a great deal or fair amount of confidence in elected officials, compared with 76% who say they have not too much or no confidence in them. Let's frame these findings correctly. The people who are paying attention, from 60 to 76%, don't trust scientists, medical scientists, the military, school principals, journalists, business leaders, or elected officials. In any election, that's called a landslide. The only people with any trust in these groups are either terminally stupid, probably as a result of their Ivy League education, or longtime addiction to the New York Times, CNN, or the Washington Post, or they've been living under a rock for the past decade. We are in the majority. When Trump was elected in 2016, I'd say about a third of the time I was out in public, about a third of the people who'd come up to talk to me had some criticism or negative comment to make about supporting Trump or some other observation I'd made about the election. In the past 9 months, even though I still go out in public often, I don't think I've had a single negative comment made to me. The people who come up to me are black, white, Asian, gay, straight, etc., with crew cuts, long hair, tattoos, pink or blue hair, and universally, They'll tell me how much they appreciate me, or how they once thought I was crazy, but now they've seen the light. There is no doubt we have suffered great losses in the COVID war, but these losses have opened the eyes of so many. Don't let them convince you that we are losing. This has been a marathon war, and though we have lost some battles, we have won many more. And as we go forward, I believe we will never let ourselves be slaves again. Too many of us are awake. As this book was being finished on July 27, 2023, the following article about a secret Chinese lab in Fresno County, California, was published by NBC News. Local and federal authorities spent months investigating a warehouse in Fresno County, California, that they suspect was home to an illegal, unlicensed laboratory full of lab mice, medical waste, and hazardous materials. Hundreds of mice at the warehouse were kept in inhumane conditions, court documents said. The city took possession of the animals in April, euthanizing 773 of them. More than 175 were found dead. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention tested the substances and detected at least 20 potentially infectious agents, including coronavirus, HIV, hepatitis, and herpes, according to a Health and Human Services letter dated June 6th. The other addresses provided for identified authorized agents were either empty offices or addresses in China that could not be verified, court documents said. And you thought you simply needed to worry about secret bio labs in China, or possibly in Ukraine. There might be a bio lab in your town, or in the next county, run by the Chinese, or possibly even our own intelligence services, and you would have no information about it until something goes wrong. The mad scientist cabal needs to be broken up and reconstituted into a force that serves humanity rather than planning for its destruction.